From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Chris Sidorick. This is Radio Boston. Coming up.
You know, they're still looking for collusion. Where is the collusion? Find some collusion. We want to find the collusion.
We'll dig into the legal ramifications of Paul Manafort's conviction and Michael Cohen's guilty plea in the ongoing special counsel investigation. Also today, Red Sox lose three in a row for the first time since April. Time to panic?
It's just been three games. You know, we've done great this year and still in first, so we've got to keep that in mind.
And celebrating Leonard Bernstein's 100th birthday.
He really loved music, and I think he wanted to show that music is really for all of us, for everyone.
That's all coming up next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Chris Sidorick. A dramatic day in federal court yesterday, with major developments for the Mueller investigation unfolding in two courtrooms, one in Virginia, the other in New York, both involving close associates of President Donald Trump. The first, Paul Manafort, the former Trump campaign chairman. He was found guilty on 8 charges of tax evasion and bank fraud. The jury couldn't reach a consensus on the remaining 10 charges. Here's Manafort's lawyer, Kevin Downing.
Mr. Manafort is disappointed of not getting acquittals all the way through or a complete hung jury on all counts.
The other associate, Michael Cohen. He's known as the Fixer, and he served as Trump's personal lawyer. Cohen entered a guilty plea to charges of campaign finance fraud involving the payment of hush money to two women who were allegedly threatening to go public with their stories about having an affair with Trump. Here's Cohen's lawyer, Lanny Davis.
I think he recognized that he needed to step up to the line and take responsibility in order to turn a corner and tell the truth from this point on about Donald Trump.
Manafort and Cohen are just the latest to be entangled in the Mueller investigation. They joined George Papadopoulos, a Trump campaign consultant who pleaded guilty to lying to the FBI about Russia-connected campaign dirt. Rick Gates, Manafort's deputy with the campaign, who pleaded guilty to conspiracy and lying to the FBI. And Michael Flynn, Trump's former national security advisor, who pleaded guilty to lying to the FBI about his relationship with Russia. But how close does all this come to the president himself? And what are the legal ramifications for the Mueller investigation moving forward? For more on that, we're joined now on the line by former federal judge Nancy Gertner. She's a senior lecturer at Harvard Law School and WBUR's legal analyst. Judge Gertner, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Good to be on again.
Also with us on the line from Kentucky is Matthew Hyman. He's a visiting fellow at George Mason's National Security Institute and a former lawyer for the Department of Justice. Matthew, welcome back to you as well.
Great to be on again. Thanks for having me.
So obviously a lot to unpack here. Let's start by trying to put the pieces together, and let's start with Paul Manafort. He was found guilty on 8 counts. There were 10 counts that the jury could not reach a consensus on. He's convicted of 5 counts of tax fraud, 2 counts of bank fraud, 1 count of failure to disclose a foreign bank account. Judge Gertner, let me start with you. What was your reaction hearing the verdict yesterday?
Well, I wasn't surprised. I wasn't surprised that the jury hung on some of this. It was largely a document case, and at least from a preliminary analysis, it looks like the jury went in a unanimous, what could be unanimous, on those issues that were principally without Rick Gates, that didn't depend on Rick Gates, and arguably hung, this is all speculation after the fact, but arguably hung on the Rick Gates issues. Manafort, although the president says is not about Russian collusion, Manafort is actually... it's actually more complicated than that. Essentially, the special counsel got to Manafort following the money. In other words, he was making money from Russian-involved Ukrainian politicians, and they followed where it went and whether or not it went to anyone else in the U.S. other than Manafort. And in doing that, they then uncovered the foreign accounts, and they uncovered tax evasion. And when they did that, they turned that over to the Southern District of New York rather than proceeding going forward. The question now is what Manafort is going to do facing what could be a 6 or 7 year term, at least on the charges in Virginia, and who knows what if were he to be found guilty in Washington.
So, Matthew, let me ask you. Some of the criticism of the Mueller investigation from the president and others has been that, as you've seen in the Manafort trial, these charges are not necessarily directly connected to the 2016 campaign. Did you feel that any of these are outside the scope?
Well, I think they are outside the scope of the 2016 campaign. I think they are outside of the scope of what is generally talked about in the media as Russia collusion, which means the allegation that Trump or his associates were somehow colluding with the Russian government in a way to advantage Trump in the electoral contest against Hillary Clinton in 2016. I agree with the judge in the sense that they followed the money. I think it's also important, though, for folks to remember that a lot of this activity that Manafort was involved in long predated the campaign, some of it going back 10 years or more. I do think it is not a – it's obviously not a positive thing for President Trump to have his former campaign manager involved in this kind of scenario. But I'm sure we'll get on to the Cohen matter. But I think as between the two matters in terms of vulnerability for the president or things that pose some risk to the president, either legal or political, the Cohen matter is probably of greater risk than the Manafort matter.
Yeah, and we will get to the Cohen matter in just a moment. Judge Gertner, I do want to ask you, fascinating to see from the outside the timing of this. I don't know if there's anything to that, but these stories broke within minutes of each other yesterday. Do you make anything of that?
Well, this is complete speculation. I think that we have seen with Mueller, it was not unusual in which to see events happen in pairs. You know, the Manafort indictment, and then you wind up with one of the Russian indictments. I think it was Gates that came out, or Papadopoulos. I've forgotten which one. Someone more directly related to the Russian investigation was paired with the Manafort indictment. The timing of the Cohen plea agreement, to some degree, was determined by Lanny Davis on the one hand and Mueller's team on the other. And I wonder, this is speculation, that they were worried about the Virginia jury because of, frankly, the bias of the judge in that. They were worried about the outcome of that, and they wanted to make sure that this came out before there was a verdict or a hung jury in that case, because the Cohen matter was completely of the government and Cohen's lawyers. The timing of that was completely in their control. It didn't have to be yesterday. But I wondered if they rushed to finish it precisely because of that. And likewise, I wonder whether the reason why there's no cooperation agreement on the face of the plea agreement, when it's clear Cohen is going to cooperate, is because it was only a week or so ago that the judge in the Cohen case determined how many of the materials that were found during the Cohen search were not protected by the privilege. So the government may not know exactly what they got and therefore couldn't finish a cooperation agreement. So they went ahead with a plea agreement, leaving open the question of cooperation.
Matthew, let me ask you.
Did this timing because of Manafort.
Matthew, what do you think? Is there anything to make of the timing or total coincidence?
I think it's interesting speculation on the judge's part. I tend to doubt that this was somehow coordinated and, that Special Counsel Mueller orchestrated all this, because in my experience, there are so many moving parts. Obviously, the jury was going to come back whenever it was done with its deliberation. And while the Cohen announcement was in the government's control, it's also in Cohen and his counsel's control. And I just think there are too many moving parts to assume that this was all just lined up by Special Counsel Mueller. I also don't, the only way that would work is if Special Counsel Mueller and Lanny Davis and his client Michael Cohen had all agreed on what was going to be announced days ago, and they just sort of put it on ice. And I think that's a stretch.
All right, so let's dig into the Cohen matter as well. He's the former personal attorney for President Trump. The president tweeting today, quote, "If anyone is looking for a good lawyer, I would strongly suggest that you don't retain the services of Michael Cohen." But let's also hear from Cohen's lawyer, Lanny Davis. He spoke with NPR's Morning Edition earlier this morning.
"I know that Michael Cohen decided to tell the truth, and that's the new life that he's now dedicated to. And when he tells the truth, to the special counsel who talks to him. He will have topics that, in my opinion, will be of interest to the special counsel in his Russian investigation and related topics.
So I think the major question here, and Judge Gertner, I'll start with you, since you said you expect Cohen to cooperate with the Mueller investigation. Does Cohen have a credibility problem? You're talking about someone who is basically coming forward and saying, I have lied about all of these things, but from here on out, I'm going to tell the truth. How do you reconcile that?
Sure, he has a credibility problem, but the government not infrequently relies on cooperating witnesses who suddenly see religion, you know, suddenly get religion. That's not unusual at all. The question, as with Rick Gates in the Manafort case, will be how much of what Cohen said is actually will be backed up by documents, will be backed up by, other witnesses. So, yeah, he has a credibility problem. There's no question about it. And that may be part of the reason why it was done the way it was done, which is he pleads guilty first to really a very onerous plea agreement, I might add, gives up his rights to an appeal. I can't believe that in the back of everyone's mind was not another round in which he would cooperate and the government would file a motion to reduce any sentence that he got.
All right, Matthew, let me ask you, what do you make of Cohen's credibility issue and how dangerous, legally speaking, is this for President Trump?
Well, I agree with the judge. He's got a huge credibility problem, and she's right. All witnesses in these circumstances, where he is both a defendant and now pled guilty, and now he's becoming a witness for possibly future actions, they do face these credibility problems. I think his lawyer is doing what good lawyers do, and Lanny Davis, you heard him there, saying, oh, he's found religion, he wants to tell the truth, he wants to share all the scintillating details he has with the special counsel. I think Lanny Davis is doing his client a good service by trying to amplify how meaningful and important the information Cohen has so he can sell it as effectively as he can. But ultimately, as the judge said, the proof's in the pudding. What kind of documents does Cohen have? What was he actually witness to? How strong can his testimony be on things that really could implicate or jeopardize Trump and his close associates in a real way beyond being the, quote, fixer of Trump's personal relationship issues that he's trying to manage?
So you guys have both mentioned this idea of corroborating evidence. That leads me to the question, Judge Gertner, I'll ask you, how is the information collected by a lawyer on his client, is that usable for the Mueller investigation? Is it admissible? What's the challenge going to be there?
Well, that's an interesting question. The judge that was the special master in the case that was looking over the documents found in Cohen's office found that the vast majority of them were not protected by the attorney-client privilege. So just because you're doing something for a client, if you're doing business dealings, or it's not clear that everything that you do for a client is covered by the privilege, and then surely the things that you're not doing for a client but doing for others in his family are not covered. We don't know what the meets and bounds of that would be. I have just a question here, and it's something I haven't had an opportunity to look at between yesterday and today. Cohen, or I believe Trump's lawyer, figures, I believe, in the Steele dossier. And so the question would be, what would Cohen's role be in confirming any portion of the Steele dossier, where Trump went and when, and whether his corroboration would be covered by the privilege, which I doubt.
Matthew, we've heard Judge Gertner talk about the president's tweets in regards to obstruction of justice. I'm curious where you stand when the president is tweeting out things like Attorney General Jeff Sessions should stop this rigged witch hunt, or tweeting good things about Paul Manafort as a jury is deliberating. Is he exposing himself to obstruction of justice risk here?
I don't think he exposes himself to any real obstruction of justice risk based on those tweets. I think saying Jeff Sessions should do X, Y, and Z, that's a statement of his opinion. And frankly, as the president, as the head of the executive branch, he could order Jeff Sessions to do things. And he always seems to frame it as, well, Jeff Sessions should do X or Y. I think on the other tweet that you noted, again, I think he's he's saying things while the jury's out deliberating. Certainly not something I would have advised the president to do, and not good form. But again, I don't see it obstructing justice the way lawyers think about that and the elements to that crime.
So he does use the word should, which is interesting, but he is also Jeff Sessions' boss, technically speaking. Judge Gertner, what do you think about the use of Twitter by the president?
Well, I mean, I think that it sort of gilds the lily here. I mean, I think that the more interesting question is what he is saying in private, what he is saying, what he said to Comey, what he's saying to Sessions, the kinds of moves that he's making in terms of what the kind of moves that he's making in the Department of Justice and what's animating those moves. I think that we're in a new place here. It's hard to imagine that tweets. How they figure into anything at this point. So, I mean, I agree that the things he's saying could as much be taken as obstruction of justice as they can be taken of and nothing more.
All right. So I guess the final question I want to ask both of you guys is that what we're seeing here is essentially kind of a high-stakes chess game being played out by both sides. Where do you see this going next, and how do the events of yesterday play into that? And let's start with you, Matthew.
Well, obviously Manafort has a second trial, as Judge Gertner mentioned. He's got a trial in D.C. that's going to start in September, and that's going to cover his failure to register as a foreign agent, and as well as money laundering charges. So he's still got a ways to travel through the justice system. I would expect that there will be continuing debates back and forth between Special Counsel Mueller and Trump's legal team as to whether Trump sits down for testimony and does the Special Counsel have to issue a subpoena, which could ultimately lead through a fight through the court systems all the way up to the Supreme Court as to whether President Trump has to sit for that testimony. So I think there's still a lot of action to come, and there could be more criminal charges coming for additional figures. We just simply don't know because we're waiting for Mueller to signal that his investigation is drawing to a close, which we'll have that sense when he writes his final report and delivers it to the Deputy Attorney General Rosenstein.
And Judge Gertner, final word for you. Where do you think we go from here?
Well, I mean, I think that Manafort will be under enormous pressure to cooperate. The money laundering D.C. foreign agent charges are much more serious in some respects, exposes him actually to more time. He has something to say because he's present at the time that the Republican the platform changed with respect to the Ukraine to a much more pro-Russian change. Whether he will cooperate is anybody's business at this point. And I think Cohen is the interesting question here. How far Mueller goes to confront legal issues in the courts is an open question. Will he subpoena the president? And I agree that subpoena will be contested and go all the way up to the Supreme Court. And which Supreme Court will it be? Will it be a Supreme Court with Kavanaugh on it or not? Or a 4-4 divided court? So I think the legal issues are complicated. The question is, how much of them does Mueller want to take on in an already complicated investigation?
Well, that's Nancy Gertner. She's a former federal judge and now a senior lecturer at Harvard Law School and WBUR's legal analyst. Judge Gertner, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks a lot.
And also Matthew Hyman. He's a visiting fellow at George Mason's National Security Institute and a former lawyer for the Department of Justice. Thanks to you as well, Matthew.
Thank you, Chris.
Stay with us. Coming up, Boston Symphony Orchestra music director Andras Nelsons on conductor Leonard Bernstein. Looking forward to his 100th birthday. I'm Chris Sitterick. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Chris Sitterick.
Maria, I've just met a girl named Maria, and suddenly that name will never be the same to me.
This weekend will mark the 100th birthday of musician, composer, conductor, and educator Leonard Bernstein. Bernstein is most well known for scoring the Broadway hit West Side Story and songs like Maria and Somewhere. Born in Lawrence, Massachusetts, he was a member of the first class of fellows of the Tanglewood Music Center, where he was a protege of then-BSO music director Serge Koussevitzky. Tanglewood held a special place in Bernstein's heart, and he returned there throughout his life to teach and to conduct. On Saturday, the BSO will host a centennial celebration there. Earlier this week, we spoke with BSO music director Andres Nelsons, who told us that Bernstein's spirit has been present at Tanglewood all summer long, particularly last week, in a moment that Nelsons felt was truly mystical and powerfully symbolic of Bernstein's passion for celebrating music. Nelsons was joined on stage at Tanglewood by world-renowned cellist Yo-Yo Ma. The music lulled to a whisper, and then...
At one point, when we played, we heard the birds singing, and we looked to each other with Yo-Yo, and it was really like a ghost of Bernstein, like he would be there, and you know, it was quiet music, quiet, and then the birds started to sing, and then we, yeah, it was very interesting. So I think there are a lot of mystical things, and a lot of atmospheric and things, and even the nature is celebrating, I think, Leonard Bernstein.
Yeah, it sounds like a beautiful moment. One of the things I know that he was so proud of was his ability to kind of bring people into the musical world, and specifically into the classical world, that might not necessarily have felt either engaged with classical music or interested in classical music. As Marin Alsop, the music director of the Baltimore Symphony Orchestra, put it, quote, mm-hmm. Bernstein was the consummate amalgam of highbrow, lowbrow, and every other brow. can you talk a little bit about kind of how he was able to bring so many people into that world?
I think first, of course, he really loved music. And I think he wanted to show that music is really for all of us, for everyone. There is so much different genres and different styles of music, but we can find a composer or a piece which we will find being close to our souls. And I think Bernstein, either in his lectures about music or in his interpretations as a conductor or his pieces or his lifestyle, he just showed, yes, that's for all of us, and that's when we really need this, we'll need music as a food, you know, as a food for our souls.
That brings me to a really interesting question. You mentioned he was very involved in social issues. He was very active in the civil rights movement, for example. Mm-hmm. There's a beautiful quote by one of his daughters, Jamie. She said about him that, "I think he felt like if he could just write the perfect melody, he could heal the world." So I just want to get your thoughts. Do you think there's something special about celebrating Bernstein kind of in the current cultural moment that we're at right now?
Yes, I think that's, you know, it is, you're absolutely right. I think in these times, particularly what we see the lack of humanism, of ethic, of trying to hear each other, trying to solve problems with the talking, with respect, with love. There is these values which are so important for our lives are absolutely, of course, present in music. And I think maybe now even more so than at any other times, it's really, really important that the arts and culture is supported and is always present.
Yeah, I think I want to let's take this as a chance to listen to some of his music. This is a selection from West Side Story, a work that kind of tells the kind of that grappling with whether we have tribal identities or whether we are all one, and kind of bringing all of those worlds together. And I think actually that this is the first piece of Bernstein's that you ever heard. So this is a little selection from Mambo from West Side Story. Let's take a listen. So tell me a little bit about what you hear in that and kind of how it speaks to Bernstein and his contributions to the musical world.
I think Bernstein used so much of a variety of different forms. It's almost sometimes sounds like a jazz music, sometimes it sounds more classical, sometimes it's very dramatic, like really like the mambo, the actual dance, which is, you know, Bernstein was a master of bringing these human feelings through his music very very much greatly forwards.
Yeah, his music was really kind of that melting pot that represents America, and he's, you know, often considered a really quintessential American. I'm just curious because you're from Latvia and you lived under the former Soviet Union. What's it like for you to be a part of the celebration of such an American icon?
Yes, absolutely. I it's so interesting. At that time, there was not much information about Bernstein or about anything really truthful what happens in America or in other parts of the world. But after the collapsing of the Soviet Union, of course, so many things came available, and of course, and then the first for me it was of course West Side Story, and as you say, it in a way symbolized the expression of freedom, and I think Bernstein is one of the champions who I think in a way presented this democracy in a very positive way, in a very very human way, the freedom of human expression, which is really what I think the democracy is about.
Yeah, I want to ask you specifically about Tanglewood because that's where you are now, and obviously. Bernstein had a very close relationship with Tanglewood. It's where he got his first taste of acclaim as a conductor. He was accepted to a conducting class there, led by Serge Koussevitzky. He taught there for many years, and then he ended up conducting his last concert there 2 months before he passed in 1990. I want to read you a quick part of a letter that he wrote to Koussevitzky in August 1940 after his first summer at Tanglewood. He writes, quote, "This summer to me was beauty. Beauty in work and strength of purpose and cooperation. I am full of humility and gratitude for having shared so richly in it. These last 6 weeks have been the happiest and most productive of my life." What do you think it is about Tanglewood that was so special to him and kept him coming back? And do you feel a connection to Tanglewood as well?
I could see any student writing such a letter after spending these intensive, amazing weeks here in Tanglewood. It is a very unique place, and it's also beautiful atmosphere, and it really feels like in some like a paradise.
Yeah, I'm sure it's hard to choose a favorite, but do you have a favorite selection from Bernstein that really speaks to you?
Oh yeah, it's difficult really. Somewhere, no, there's a place for us to eat. Oh no. From West Side Story.
That's Andres Nelsons, music director for the Boston Symphony Orchestra. We spoke with him earlier this week from Tanglewood. One of the things Bernstein was best known for was his contagious enthusiasm for music. And joining us now from Tanglewood is someone who got to experience that firsthand as one of the many students who studied under Leonard Bernstein, Jenny Shames. She's a violinist with the Boston Symphony Orchestra. She first met Bernstein in 1974 as a student at the Boston University High School program at Tanglewood and was later a student of Bernstein's after being awarded a Tanglewood Music Center Fellowship in 1976. Jenny, welcome to Radio Boston.
Pleasure to be here, Chris.
So you grew up in Boston. You come from a musical family, and I know you listened frequently to Bernstein's music. What was it that struck you about his work?
Well, you asked me to come in and speak just after hearing that most gorgeous melody of Somewhere.
I know.
It's very
eyes closed
hard to
in the
speak
studio
after
here.
That, really. Leonard Bernstein's been a part of my life, my entire life. West Side Story was the first movie I ever saw in a movie theater. And his music was beauty to me even as a child. I grew up watching his Young People's concerts as events of the year, just as The Wizard of Oz was on television or Sound of Music. It was a once-a-year event that the entire country watched. And as a musician, as a Bostonian, as a Jewish Bostonian from a musical family, I felt a great pride in what I thought was a connection to Leonard Bernstein even before I met him.
You had the opportunity to study under Bernstein at Tanglewood for years. What was it like to meet him and to work with him?
I like the way you put that, to study under him, because even in playing under him in the Boston Symphony, he was a teacher always on the podium with a professional orchestra or with the students. My first time I played under him was as a student, and it was both petrifying and thrilling, as you might imagine.
Sure.
I was concertmaster for the Tanglewood Festival Orchestra for his concert, which was always the biggest concert of the year. And by the way, his concert with the BSO was typically the biggest concert of the year as well. I was scared, but I was so thrilled and in awe. And from the second he walked on the podium, there was an energy that's almost indescribable. There was such a breath of excitement and knowledge and love of music coming out of him every second. I always described it as the ground sort of sizzled when he was on the podium.
Wow.
And it was thrilling.
He was kind of known for that trademark style of being really emotional and into the music as he conducts. He was one of the first conductors to really kind of do that. Was it jarring at all as a musician to play under that style?
Well, I loved it. In fact, there are still iconic Bernstein leaps that I sort of see in my head in certain pieces of music, specifically in like Shostakovich Fifth or Mahler Second. There were movements that were so thrilling that I still see them every time I play those pieces. Ironically, though, there were moments when he didn't move at all on the podium. And what thrilled me the most sometimes was that he didn't have to do anything for an entire orchestra to know exactly what he wanted. It was through a movement of his eyes or a movement of his hip, and everyone went with him. And to this day, I can't tell you how, but I did find it very thrilling. I found it fascinating.
So I do have to ask a bit of a difficult question. Bernstein has been described in many places as someone who liked to break boundaries, and whether you're talking about in a way of bringing classical music to people who might never come across it, you know, spreading the reach. He was also described as breaking boundaries in his personal life. His daughter wrote in a book about forcing tongue kisses sometimes. Did you ever experience any of that in working with him?
Well, not to that extent, of course, but he could be a very difficult man. He didn't like boundaries. Somebody asked me once about his overtime practices because, you know, an orchestra rehearsal has a specific time. He did not like to be bound by earthly requirements, was my answer to them. He wanted to live life as he wanted to live it, and it was large. So, yes, we saw it every time he was on the podium. When he even came out to do Boston Symphony rehearsals, there was a bit of a dance that happened first where he would walk around and kiss the people that he sort of traditionally would kiss. Mostly it was the principal players in the orchestra, and it was always on the lips. And the biggest joke was that Joseph Silverstein, who was the concertmaster in the beginning of my career in the Boston Symphony, would run away from his seat so that Bernstein couldn't get to him. So there was a bit of a dance at the beginning of every rehearsal. It sort of became a joke, but it was definitely there in every aspect of his life.
Yeah. So I want to spend some time, obviously, celebrating the music. That's what he was all about. We've talked a bit about his work with West Side Story already, so I want to play another piece of music for him that I know that you love. This is from the end of Bernstein's Symphony No. 2, The Age of Anxiety, recorded by the New York Philharmonic Orchestra, conducted by Bernstein. It was composed between 1948 and 1949 in the United States and Israel. He dedicated the piece to Serge Koussevitzky. Let's take a listen. All right, so what do you feel hearing that?
You know, I feel a triumphant sound. I feel a triumphant feeling listening to that. The Age of Anxiety, as is most of his music, consists of a struggle in his faith, a struggle between life and death, a struggle between good and bad. And much of his music ends with a tragic note. That sound to me is much more triumphant. And I've used this word a lot in this interview. I just found that thrilling, just hearing that music. It's very iconic Bernstein. He had harmonies that were existent in through all of his, they were like threads through all of his music. And I think if I were to just have heard that on the radio, I would have known that was Bernstein.
Yeah, a lot of people say that, that within a few notes, you can recognize it as Bernstein's. So I want to play another moment from that symphony. This is Bernstein's Symphony No. 2, The Age of Anxiety. And I believe this is your favorite moment of music of all time. Let's take a listen. Favorite moment of music of all time. That is such high praise. What is it about those notes, that arrangement?
It's some of it is in the visual, which of course we can't see because we're talking on radio. It's an incredibly difficult part of the piece for the conductor to conduct, and I had seen Bernstein conduct it, and it was a thing of beauty, first of all. So I have that in my head, but this piece is coming out of a very dark introduction in the piece, and that struggle that I was talking about. And so often with Leonard Bernstein, when the struggle got too difficult, you went and had a party. And you had the most decadent party you possibly could. And that mask just says that all to me. It is the most outrageous moment of jazz combined with classical tonal music combined with atonal music. And it the combination, it's only piano and percussion for minutes. So the rest of us have the pleasure of listening to it. And it is just a thing of beauty to me, both listening to it, listening to my colleagues play it, remembering Bernstein conducting it, also remembering Seiji Ozawa conducting it. It's an incredibly difficult part of the piece to conduct, but I just think it's life is too difficult. Let's just live it.
So
one of the best we can.
It's beautiful. One of the praises that Bernstein often gets was the range that he worked in, from Broadway to kind of popish to classical. And so from what you say is let's have a party to somewhat serious, I want to play a piece from Halil. He dedicated this to an Israeli flute student who was killed in his tank close to the Suez Canal during the 1973 Yom Kippur War. Halil, as you know, means flute in Hebrew. This was first played in 1981. Let's listen. So you mentioned struggle earlier, and Bernstein actually wrote that Halil was, quote, unlike any other work I have written, but it is like much of my music in its struggle between tonal and non-tonal forces. In this case, I sense that struggle as involving wars and the threats of wars, the overwhelming desire to live, and the consolations of art, love, and the hope for peace. Can you talk a little bit about the struggle that you hear in that piece?
Actually, when you first started that excerpt, there's a great struggle. It's very harsh sounding in the percussion in relation to the solo flute, and all of a sudden the flute breaks through and has almost a carefree dance for a second, and then back to the very difficult atonal sounds that come with the percussion again and come into it. And Halil, that struggle for Bernstein, at least I imagine it to be this, is the struggle between war and peace in his beloved Israel, the survival of the whole Jewish nation. I think he was not particularly a religious person, but he was a very culturally Jewish man and was very close to the state of Israel. So I think that even became more so in that piece. At least I find it much more emotional.
Well, so much to celebrate. Jenny Shames, you're a violinist with the Boston Symphony Orchestra. You'll be celebrating Leonard Bernstein's 100th birthday on Saturday. Thanks so much for joining us today.
A pleasure. Thank you so much.
Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Chris Sidorek. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Chris Sidorek. It's Wednesday, time to talk sports. Today we're going to focus on the story of former Patriots tight end Aaron Hernandez. Hernandez's lawyer, Jose Baez, has a new book out. It's titled Unnecessary Roughness, Inside the Trial and the Final Days of Aaron Hernandez. It was released yesterday and, perhaps unsurprisingly, paints a very different picture of Hernandez. The book comes as the Boston Globe's noted spotlight team is hard at work on a new podcast that will explore the Hernandez saga, set to be released sometime this fall. Ben Volen is a senior NFL writer for the Boston Globe and part of the team working on that podcast, and he joins us now. Ben, welcome to Radio Boston.
Chris, thank you so much for having me today.
So we'll get to the Baez book in a minute. I know you got an advanced copy, but before we jump right into that, I want to ask you about kind of the Hernandez story as a whole. The Spotlight team, obviously best known for exposing the Catholic Church abuse scandal. They focus on true, deep investigative reporting. What was it about the Hernandez story that you guys thought would make a good topic to explore?
It's such a – and first of all, I'm not part of the Spotlight team as much as I would like to be. I'm a contributor to this certain project, so I just want to be clear about that. However, this is such a fascinating cross-section of murder and intrigue and celebrity and professional sports. And when do you ever see an athlete in the prime of his career, really just entering the prime of his career, a $40 million contract, 23 years old, throw it all away and be convicted of murder and then be involved in a second murder trial where he was eventually found not guilty. But it's just, you know, you have O.J. Simpson, that might be the only comparable, but he was 20 years retired at that point. Aaron Hernandez is just such a captivating and in some ways tragic figure in that he threw everything away, and obviously his life ended very young at age 27. And then you throw in another cross-section of the CTE angle. Aaron was found posthumously to have stage 3 CTE. It's the most advanced form they've ever found in someone of his age. And I think it certainly needs to be investigated further and researched further what kind of role does CTE play in someone's behavior, and why did Aaron develop such an advanced stage of CTE as well. So I think there's just so many different angles to this story that make it such a fascinating topic.
Is there a singular kind of line or theme that follows through the podcast as you kind of explore the story, or is it kind of a mosaic of all these different issues?
Yeah, I believe, again, I've just been a part of it. I had sat down for a long interview of the podcast, but I'm not part of the production side. But I do believe it's trying to just tell the most complete picture yet of Aaron Hernandez, and I believe it's kind of like a serial type podcast where it's going to go through the true crime elements of probably all the various cases, and certainly the one where he was found not guilty of the double murder, and that one never really got solved. So I think they're going to look deeply into some of the evidence there and some of the stories swirling around Hernandez and his off-field life and what led him down this road of crime here in his young life. So it's going to be a very fascinating listen. It comes out sometime during the beginning of the football season, September, October, somewhere in there. And, you know, having not seen it fully, I do know the Spotlight team. Certainly, they always come together with some good projects.
Yeah, I'm sure. So you obviously got an advanced copy of the Baez book. This was kind of an interesting angle because obviously we've heard the narrative that's been told. This is told by somebody who clearly has an interest in defending Hernandez, so you have to take things with a grain of salt. But what did you take out of the book? Was there anything new that you learned, anything interesting that jumped out?
Certainly, take it with a grain of salt is a good way I would put it. You know, I was going into this book hoping for some clarity on Aaron Hernandez and who he was, and certainly Jose Baez does definitively tell you certain things. You know, he quashes the rumor about some of the jailhouse letters and some of the rumors about Aaron Hernandez, but you walk away from the book feeling more conflicted than ever, not knowing what to believe anymore about Aaron Hernandez. And that's, frankly, a testament to Jose Baez and his ability to create reasonable doubt. He has alternative theories for everything, for the shooting in West Palm Beach where Hernandez's friend lost his eye, and for the shooting in Gainesville when Aaron was in college. And he has alternative theories for the double murder. And he believes that if he were representing Aaron Hernandez on the Odin Lloyd case, he could have created enough reasonable doubt and got him off that one as well. And
Did you find any of it believable as you're going through it?
Some of it is certainly eye roll inducing. there was one anecdote where while Aaron was at college, his coach Urban Meyer was so incensed with Aaron and his reckless disregard of the rules that he wanted to kick Aaron off the team. But Tim Tebow stepped in and said, if you kick Aaron off, then you have to kick me off too. And so Urban Meyer relented and then said, but you have to leave the program after the season no matter what. So that one I said to Jose straight up, I said, I'm having a hard time believing that one. And his answer was, well, you know, I can only go by what Aaron told me. So that's what a lot of it, you know, Jose Baez passing along what Aaron Hernandez told to him without much scrutiny. So, but, you know, so he does a good job of creating some reasonable doubt about a lot of different events in Aaron's life. And frankly, you just don't know what to believe anymore.
Yeah. You mentioned the CTE at the top. One of the things I was struck by that I've come across in reading about what's in the book, the suicide letters that Baez published. Three letters, one to Baez, one to Hernandez's fiance, and one to Hernandez's daughter. Some troubling stuff in there, kind of not much time, I'm being called, do not go back to living while worshiping false idols, it's time, the real live forever. What did you take out of those?
Baez published the three letters, quashing one of the rumors that one of them was for Aaron's jailhouse lover, which turned out to be a total hoax, a guy looking for a payout, basically. The letter to Jose Baez was more upbeat and positive and did not have the trappings of a suicide note. But then the notes to his fiance and to his daughter, you could tell, were certainly ominous and something that Aaron had been thinking about for a while. And it's another fascinating angle of the story is that it had come on the heels just 5 days later after he had been acquitted of the double murder. And finally, there's a ray of sunshine. Jose Baez was about to tackle his mandatory appeal on the Odin Lloyd murder. And certainly he was facing high odds, but at least he had a glimmer of hope at that point. And that's when he decided to end his life, which, again, is just another element of intrigue and mystery to this whole story. So it's, you know, so publishing the jailhouse letters was certainly a fascinating play by Jose Baez.
And now you covered Hernandez all the way back to the days at the University of Florida.
Correct.
Was there any inclination that he might kill himself, or were you completely surprised when that news broke?
I was definitely taken aback when that news broke. Certainly, you know, a kid in his
position. Obviously facing
someone in his position where he's facing life in jail, and you know how you've thrown it all away, and you had everything. You're living the professional athlete life, and now here you are in a 17-by-12 cell. So I can certainly understand why he would kill himself, and I'm a little baffled why he wasn't on further suicide watch and wasn't being monitored closely. Just the whole episode is obviously shocking. You know, there's a lot of innuendo from Jose Baez that the Patriots kind of knew what kind of person Hernandez was, and I think that's true. I think we all knew that he was running with the wrong crowd and was not exactly a Boy Scout off the field, but I can't imagine anyone knew he was capable of murder, which he was convicted of, and no one knew the full extent of it. And you never expect someone in his position with the contract and everything ahead of him to just so carelessly and recklessly be willing to throw it all away. So everyone was just so taken aback when he was directly charged with murder the first time.
You mentioned the role of the team there. I know there was an excerpt in the book where Baez mentions that Hernandez was actually looking for a trade because he had received death threats. And I know Baez kind of questions, well, what could have happened? You're a senior NFL writer for the Globe. Have you ever heard of a player requesting a trade for any kind of scenario like that, where they feared for their life?
That's a new one for me. Again, it's what makes this such a remarkable episode. So the story that Jose Baez presents is that Aaron Hernandez was getting these threatening text messages from his friend whom he allegedly shot in the face, and he said he feared for his life, and he went to Belichick and requested a trade, said, please trade me to the West Coast, far away from here. And supposedly Belichick was incensed by the idea. We've invested a lot of money into you, a $40 million contract. We have big plans to make you the centerpiece of our offense, you and Rob Gronkowski. So Bill Belichick did not entertain it, and he said, go see our director of security, get a secondary residence where you can hide out or whatever. And that's how Belichick decided to handle it. And, you know, I don't necessarily blame him that you can't have players be dictating, you know, what they – but so anyway, so Jose Baez in the book says, well, what – you know, he blames the Patriots and Belichick for not taking it seriously and how things would have changed had they done that and traded Aaron away. Well – again, I don't think Belichick ever expected it to end that the way it did.
Sure, sure. Gives you a little glimpse into kind of some of the stuff that Hernandez was dealing with, though. Well, that's Ben Volen. He's the senior NFL writer for the Boston Globe. Ben, thank you so much for joining us.
Chris,
today.
Thank you.
Appreciate the time.
Thank you.
That's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. Our show is produced by Jamie Bologna, Paris Alston, and Zoe Mitchell. Tim Skoog is our technical director. We had engineering help today from Eddie Mazulis. Our executive producer is Hitesh Hathai. I'm Chris Siderick. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.